Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 15. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Tudor Christmas is Claire Ridgway. Claire is the author of numerous best-selling Tudor books, including George Boleyn, Tudor Poet, Courtier and Diplomat, co-written with Claire Cherry, and the Anne Boleyn Collection, Volume 1 and 2. Claire worked in education and freelance writing before creating the Anne Boleyn Files history website and becoming a full-time history researcher, blogger, and author. The Anne Boleyn Files is known for its historical accuracy and Claire's mission to get to the truth behind Anne Boleyn's story. Her writing is easy to read and conversational, and readers often comment on how reading Claire's books is like having a coffee with her and chatting about history. Claire is also the founder of the Tudor Society, an online hub for all things Tudor. My conversation with Claire straight after this musical break, courtesy of singer-songwriter Carlene. The song, Born to Be Your Queen, is from Carlene's best-selling album, The Ballad of Anne Boleyn.
Make me your wife, your one and only. I'll give you everything you need. I'll give you sons, I'll give you glory, for I was born to be your queen. When they refuse and they oppose you, remember God is in your ear. You are the king and you must tell them true that I was born to be your queen.
Celebrate my name, O Anne Boleyn.
King's Queen.
Welcome to Talking Tudors, Claire. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, thank you. It's so lovely to have you on the show. Now, you and I have known each other for quite some time, but I thought it would really lovely if you might introduce yourself to our listeners and maybe just tell them a little bit about yourself and your background, possibly touching on what sparked your interest in the Tudors.
Oh, it's a long story, but I'll try and keep it short. This is going back to childhood. I mean, my father did a history degree, so he's always had a love of history. And so that was kind of instilled in me from a young age.
Right.
But I think the age of 11 was a really big sort of thing for me.
Right.
Because at that age, I had an absolutely fantastic teacher, a very inspirational teacher, who we did a topic at school on Henry VIII and his six wives.
Right.
And that I just this topic just gripped me because there was this man, this larger than life character who seemed to, you know, be executing everyone, including, you know, two of his wives.
Oh, yeah.
Plus he had six wives. And that really, really gripped me. And at the same time, we also did a sort of multi-subject topic on an island. We had to do, so it was geography-based, it was English-based, all sorts of things. And
right.
We ended up doing a creative writing project as well.
Okay.
And instead of writing an A4 page like everyone else did, I ended up writing 20-odd pages of this story, this creative writing. And so they were separate subjects, the Henry VIII and his wives.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this other project that we were doing that was creative writing. And it was just that year that my love of history developed and my love of creative writing developed. And so the two kind of have gone down in my memory as being, you know, really, really important, because from that moment on, I started doing creative writing. And from that moment on, I was completely addicted to history.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't really do much about this apart from I sort of read historical novels, you know, growing up and watched documentaries and that. But it was the end of 2008. I was working as a freelance writer. I'd done teaching previously and left that when I had my children. I was doing freelance writing and I was in a bit of a rut, writing really boring stuff for other people that wasn't my interest at all.
Yeah.
And then the Tudors came on TV, and oh, I know sometimes I wanted to throw things at the TV.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's not right. But it brought me back to my love of Tudor history. And then I've talked about this in my books, about a dream that I had, a very vivid dream in January 2009, about being present at Anne Boleyn's execution, being a member of the crowd.
Right,
and it was very vivid at the time. I can't remember the details now, but I just remember that I knew that she was innocent, but I couldn't do anything about it. And I was trying to scream, and I had that moment when, you know, your tongue's just stuck to the roof of your mouth, your throat's
horrible,
dry
in
terror. And I woke up and I was sweaty and, you know, like you are with a nightmare. And I just said to Tim, I said, I've got to start a website called The Anne Boleyn Files, and it's going to be telling the real truth about Anne Boleyn. It's going to be her story, and I'm going to research it, and I'm going to write about it. And he just went, that's fine. And at that moment, the love of writing and the love of history sort of came together, and I started the Anne Boleyn Files.
Yeah.
And it kind of saved me. It kept me sane, because I've been writing such boring stuff for other people. And it was just an opportunity to start writing about something that I felt passionate about.
Yeah.
So that is a long story cut down.
Yeah, that's a fabulous story. I love that. And just out of curiosity, do you still have the story you wrote, the 20-page story?
I do.
How fabulous. Yeah, that's so, isn't it fun to look back at things you wrote as a child and you think, oh my goodness, that's fabulous.
Written in fountain pen with all the blobs of ink on it as well.
Oh, that's a fabulous keepsake. So, Claire, with Christmas, obviously now just around the corner, I can't believe it really.
It is scary,
yeah. I thought it would be fun for us to talk about some Tudor Christmas and New Year traditions. I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about how the Tudor celebrated this time of year and maybe touch on sort of, I know there were main days of celebration, if you could touch on those and any sort of traditions associated with those days, that'd be fabulous.
Okay, well, it was very different to how it is today. I mean, today, what is it, August, I think you start seeing Christmas cards in the shops. And, as soon as it gets into November, it just goes mad. People start putting trees up and Christmas parties start, family get-togethers, and everything goes very, very Christmassy very early.
Yes.
Yeah. But in Tudor times, there were the 4 weeks of Advent leading up to Christmas. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't a time of, celebration and partying and feasting, Christmas parties. It was actually, a very strict time of observance. You were abstaining from meat during that time. No turkey dinners going out with, your work colleagues or anything. It was, it was a time of fasting. Mm. And Christmas Eve was even stricter. I mean, there was not just meat that you couldn't have. There was no cheese or eggs or anything until after you'd been to midnight mass. And then you could, celebrate because, of course, you've got the news of, Jesus, being born.
That's right,
so in those days, Advent, it was strict. It was, a time of contemplation and that. So the lead up to Christmas didn't really kind of exist in the same way as it does today.
Right,
but then you've got the 12 days of Christmas were the festive period. And I think we've lost that today because we tend to get to Christmas Day and, it then goes all quiet and have a bit of celebration for New Year. But we've lost that 12 days, that festive period.
Yeah.
So Christmas Day was the first official day of the 12 days.
Okay.
And that then ended with Twelfth Night, the eve of Epiphany. Although work, if you were like an agricultural worker or whatever, your work didn't really start until Plough Monday. You had a little bit of extra time, depending on when that Monday fell.
Right,
it was the first Monday after Twelfth Night. You'd go back to work and that was it. Then the Christmas period was over. Christmas Eve, you've got the Yule log tradition. I love this tradition.
Yeah,
I keep meaning to do it one year because we've got a forest. We live up a mountain here in Spain and we've got the Sierras, the forest.
Oh, beautiful.
Just above us. I keep thinking I ought to send, because the tradition was you send the men of the house.
Right, that sounds sexist, good.
Isn't it? But send Tim and Joel out to the forest to get a huge log, which would then be decorated with ribbons, and that log would be then dragged home.
Yes.
It would then be burnt at the house through the 12 days of Christmas. So this special log would heat the home for the festive period. And it was also lucky to keep some charred remains of this special Yule log to start next year's Yule log fire. That was seen to bring, the house good luck.
Yes.
Yeah. So you'd light that, you'd get that going on the fire, have some some lamb's wool wassail, some mulled wine, some nice spiced hot wine or ale to celebrate, and then you'd go off to midnight mass.
Okay.
The next one, Christmas Day. Now, this was a day of religious celebrations. I mean, a lot of people sort of lost that today. Mm. I mean, your Tudor people might go to up to 3 masses,
that
day, with one before dawn as well.
Goodness.
You haven't got the children waking you up for the presents.
No.
You're waking up to go to mass.
Okay.
So you'd do that, and the religious side of things would be the focus for first thing in the morning before the feasting would begin. And at church, the congregations would hold tapers, you know, lit tapers,
yes.
As the genealogy of Jesus, you know, was sung, remembering, you know, that he was from the line of David, mm-hmm. and that importance of his line. And then you could move on to the feasting.
Oh, the fun stuff. Excellent.
Oh, just the fun stuff. Yes, yes, definitely. And then the next day is the Feast of St. Stephen. We know it as Boxing Day.
Yes,
it tends to be the day where the sales start and you hit the shops and that. But those days, no. It was the traditional day in agriculture for bleeding horses and cattle.
Goodness.
Sounds lovely.
Ooh, yeah, gosh.
And also for hunting as okay. well. It was a day, you know, where the wealthy, you know, went out on the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, the days where fox hunting was still going, Boxing Day was an important day, you know, for hunting sort of in modern times as well. But there's one horrible account. I can't remember which year it is from Tudor times, where they let a cat and a fox loose at the Inner Temple.
Oh.
And then a pack of hounds was let loose after them.
Oh, goodness.
And tore them to pieces.
Oh, so, that's horrible. You know,
very festive, obviously.
Yeah, these Tudors, funny idea of festivities.
Yeah. And the next one in the sort of the 12 days of Christmas, the next real celebration, well, commemoration really, was Holy Innocents Day.
Okay.
That's on the 28th of December. It's actually still remembered here in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, it was a commemoration of the massacre of the baby boys in Bethlehem that
right,
was
okay.
ordered by King Herod, you know, in an mm-hmm. attempt to get rid of this baby Jesus who he thought was a threat to him.
Yeah.
So it was a commemoration of the massacre. And here in Spain, it's actually like April Fool's Day because
right.
it's called Holy Innocence Day. It's a day for tricking your naive friends
by
playing a joke on them.
Okay.
So, yes, our local barman told us about this because he played a trick on us one 28th of December. And he just was blown away that we didn't know what the day was and that, you know, it was traditional to play tricks.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it, to be
there
honest.
You go.
So there you go. I learned
yeah.
something new.
And then, of course, the 12 days of Christmas came to sort of an end with Epiphany.
Yes.
The 6th of January, 12th night, the previous night. It was a commemoration and celebration of the visit of the Magi to the Christ child.
Mm-hmm.
This was a huge celebration and, in fact, still is in many Catholic countries today.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of feasting and entertainment. I mean, at the Tudor royal court, if you read through accounts of Epiphany from Henry VII's reign onwards, you've got masks, pageants, mm-hmm. plays, I mean, really lavish stuff. It was a real, real day and night of celebration. Another tradition associated with that is the 12th night cake,
mm-hmm.
Which tended to contain a pea and a bean.
Right.
And it was said that the man who found the bean was crowned king of the celebrations.
Oh, fabulous.
And the woman who found the pea, I'm not quite sure how they made sure that a man found the bean and a woman found the pea, but she was the queen of the celebrations. And they celebrated with lamb's wool, which was a drink made from sort of hot cider, sherry or ale with apples and spices. That was used for the wassail, which was like a communal cup that was handed around for sort of toasting and celebrating.
Lovely.
So that was the 12 days of Christmas. I mean, I think we should bring all this back. Apart from the hunting.
Apart from ripping animals apart.
The ripping animals apart, yeah.
It sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it? The Tudors know how to have fun. That's
oh,
thing,
they
yeah.
did, yeah.
That's
I mean, fun. Obviously, we might not want to go back to Tudor times.
No, probably not.
Days,
yeah.
But they did know how to celebrate, yes, yeah. definitely.
All right, fabulous. Now, there's a tradition that I've heard quite a bit about. That's the one of the boy bishop. Do you think you could tell us a little
yeah.
bit about that particular tradition?
Well, the Tudors liked sort of turning life on its head, sort of role reversals and that. So there was this tradition of the boy bishop. It was linked to the feast of Saint Nicholas on the 6th of December.
Okay.
So that's still within the period of Advent. Mm-hmm. And it was traditional for a choir boy to be chosen on that day to be boy bishop. And it wasn't just, they didn't just dress him up in the sort of episcopal regalia and just, you know, leave it at that. He actually acted as the sort of proper bishop of the community. You know, you've got this little boy dressed up, and he was leading processions around the community to collect for church funds. He led services and prayers and thanksgivings, and that until Holy Innocence Day on the 28th. Sometimes the tradition changes slightly, but that seems to be what it was. And it was a reminder of Christ's teaching. You know, he talks about suffer the little children, come to me.
Right.
He also said, except you'll be converted and made like unto little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven.
Mm.
So it was a reminder about Christ's teaching about humility and innocence and how we need to be like little children to enter the kingdom of heaven. So it was a reminder of that. And actually, it's amazing that it's still carried on in it's Hereford and Salisbury cathedrals in the UK.
Oh, really? Okay.
They still do this. They choose a chorister. I can't remember whether it was when it was last year or the year before. A girl was chosen for the first time. They've opened it up to females as well.
Okay.
So a chorister is chosen. They have a big service on the Sunday nearest to the 6th of December, where the chorister is then, you know, sort of, well, not crowned isn't quite the right word, but made boy bishop. And then that bishop reigns for 3 weeks wearing the bishop's costume, leading prayers and blessings at the cathedral, giving sermons.
Oh my goodness. That's a long period, isn't it? Like three, it's not just one day, that's 3 weeks.
No, it's an amazing, I just love it. And so that's kind of a role reversal. Another role reversal thing is the Lord of Misrule.
Yes, that's a great one.
Happened at court, which again is sort of, it's a tradition to sort of do with humility and a tradition to do with fun.
Mm-hmm.
You would have a commoner at court being chosen as the Lord of Misrule, and then they're the ones in charge of organizing the entertainment and revelry for the 12 days of Christmas. So all this role reversal, and you can imagine this commoner going mad, you know, having a right knees up, really.
How fabulous. Definitely a lot of fun. It's a good reminder of how much they enjoyed role-playing, didn't they? They loved this whole role-playing thing and taking on other roles. And yeah, and Henry VIII obviously enjoyed it a lot. He liked dressing up, didn't he?
Oh, yes, he did. That time where he dressed up as Robin Hood and his men and surprised Catherine of Aragon and her ladies.
Exactly. And obviously they were very, you know, used to it and knew how to respond. But I'm just thinking of Poyanne of Cleves when he came up, you know, when he met her and he was in some kind of disguise and she had no clue who he was. That would have been very uncomfortable.
Yes. It's one of those what ifs. What if someone had actually taken her to one side and said, the king's on his way, he's dressed up, you know?
Exactly. That would have helped, poor thing. All right, that's fabulous. I loved all that. Now, I don't know about you, Claire, but I absolutely love decorating my home for this period of time. And I'm patiently waiting because I normally do it on the 1st of December. So, you know, I can't wait until tomorrow that I can get all my things out and, you know, decorate. But how did the Tudors decorate their homes for this sort of festive season?
Well, they didn't have things like Christmas trees.
No,
I mean, here in our family, we tend to do it the weekend nearest Immaculate Conception. I think it's the 8th of December because it's a public holiday here, and we tend to have a long weekend with the children. So we tend to do it sort of around then. And, Christmas tree, lights, you know, everything. Well, you know, the Tudors obviously didn't have the Christmas tree. That didn't come till a lot later, you know, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert. That's right. But they did use greenery. Mm. They would go out, like they did with that Yule log, they would go out into the countryside near them. Mm. They would collect things like, you know, the evergreens of holly and ivy. So you've got the green of the leaves. You've got some colour from, you know, the berries the holly. And that was brought into the home just to make the home look sort of brighter. Mm. They'd also, the Christmas bough tradition was also practiced by some. It's like the forerunner of the Christmas wreaths that we tend to hang on our doors. It was like ash or willow wood that would be sort of woven, sort of plaited together and then decorated with greenery. And that would be hung in the homes above a door or on the wall. And the idea was that guests would be welcomed to the house under this bough.
Right. Okay.
And it was like a goodwill gesture to spread goodwill and good luck. And it's a bit like how some people hang, you know, mistletoe today, you know, to kiss under the mistletoe. That's well, this right. was welcome under the Christmas bough.
It's, right.
It was that kind of thing. So greenery, really, your evergreens that, you know, wouldn't wilt and look awful in a day or two, things that would actually sort of last during the 12 days of Christmas.
Fabulous. Yeah, I love that. I do something similar here. I bring in things from the outside. It just, yeah, it looks, it reminds me of the Tudors.
Yeah. Here in Spain, we all the shops are full of poinsettias.
Oh, yes. You know,
because they're so colourful. And, you know, you have to have a poinsettia in your house.
Absolutely. I just bought one today, actually. There you go. I got one when I went grocery shopping. I bought a little one for my kitchen table. And it straight away, it just sort of spells out Christmas the minute you see it.
It does. It does, fantastic. Definitely.
Excellent. Now, obviously, an important part of our modern day Christmas is the food. The food is very, very important. And, you know, we sometimes spend weeks planning what we're going to serve our guests. What did the Tudors serve on Christmas Day?
In a way, it was similar in that you'd got the, you know, the roasted meats, you know, as being a big part of, you know, the Christmas feasting. Goose tended to be the main, you know, roast that they would have known. There have been attempts to bring it back in the UK, really. Right. Lots of chefs showing how to cook it and that, because turkey has taken over in the UK now. But they would have known turkey. Turkey did start to come in Henry VIII's reign, I think it was. And by Elizabeth's reign, it had become quite popular. And she actually said at one point she recommended people to go back to sort of eating the goose. Right. So roasted meat was a big thing. So goose, turkey, beef, and then you've got brawn and mustard. And now that was boar, wild boar, because of course wild boar were still prevalent in the woods in Tudor times. So boar was eaten. Plum porridge, mince pie. I mean, that's still a big thing. I always have to go to the English supermarkets here and buy mince pies or make my own. But they're actually different today. I mean, today they're a dessert. They're a sweet
treat.
That's right.
Yeah.
In those days, it was a savoury meat pie. It did have some sweetness in it because of the fruit in it, but it was made with meat. It contained traditionally 13 ingredients to represent Christ and his apostles. And the meat in it was mutton, as a reminder of, you know, to think back to the shepherds who are looking after their sheep when the angel Gabriel appeared to them with the good tidings of Christ's birth. So the mince pies were very different in those days. Today we still have that kind of meat element in them with the suet that tends to be put in them, but they have moved on. We don't tend to use mutton anymore. Then there was a type of pottage. I'm never sure how to pronounce this. Frumenty.
Right.
Okay. which was a pottage made with cracked wheat. Mm-hmm. So that was another dish. Of course, all washed down with plenty of ale.
Yes.
That was very important.
Yeah.
The wealthier classes would have made quite a centerpiece of their sort of Christmas feasting. Mm-hmm. They might have had like a swan or a peacock. You know, the meat would have been sort of roasted and then put back together with the skin and the feathers to look like, you know, the swan or the peacock was still alive there, sat on the table. I don't really want to be reminded that
goodness.
Or a boar's head, a boar's head sat there on the table looking at you.
I know.
So centerpieces like that. Then there was also the Tudor Christmas pie, mm-hmm. A coffin-shaped pie crust. They didn't eat the pie crusts in those days. They were really just containers.
Right, okay.
And that tended to be a turkey stuffed with a goose, which was then stuffed with a chicken, stuffed with a partridge.
Such a complicated
with a pigeon. Yes. I mean, there are recipes and videos online if anyone wants to try and replicate it.
Goodness. Yeah, send us a photo.
Very complicated.
Yeah.
And then you'd have the banquet, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, today we use the word banquet very, very loosely. Mm-hmm. But in those days, the banquet course was the sweet course, the sweet delicacies. And they made real displays of this. You had leech, which is made from milk and sugar and rose water. And then it's sort of cut into cubes. And you could make like a chessboard, a checkerboard from this sweet and sort of colour it differently to get that checkerboard effect. You'd have sugar plates, which would be sort of molded into different things. You'd have gilded fruit. And then you'd have the marchpane, which is marzipan.
Yes.
And that would be crafted into all kinds of things, into animals, people, palaces, castles, all sorts of things. And I mean, that was the wow factor, for the people that you'd invited to your home. Trying to think, other Christmas foods would include Christmas pudding. Today, pudding for us means dessert, a sweet treat. But in those days, and in fact in countries like Spain and that as well, a pudding is a kind of a sausage, and it's, you know, it's in intestines of an animal. So it's your meat, and that's stuffed into intestines. Yes.
Yeah, it's very appetizing.
Meat, spices and oatmeal, you know. Well, it's what sausages are.
Oh, exactly.
That today, that was the Christmas pudding was a sausage rather than rather than what we think of today.
That's right, as a dessert.
Gingerbread as well.
Okay. Gingerbread.
I mean, I've made Tudor style gingerbread. It's very different to what we see as gingerbread today. It was made from breadcrumbs that you mixed with spices like ginger, sugar and wine. Okay. And so the breadcrumbs soak it all up, and then you mold it and dry it, so that could be shaped into things as well. And as well as washing that down with ale, you'd also have things like mulled wine. You'd have syllabub, which is a milk drink with alcohol such as rum or wine and spices.
Okay.
The lamb's wool, which I mentioned before, which is like a hot kind of cider with apples and spices. And then you'd have more sweet treats, tarts, custard, quince marmalade, all sorts.
That's a lot of feasting, isn't it? A lot of food. My goodness.
No mention of vegetables.
No, it doesn't sound like any vegetables.
Vegetables were for the poor, really.
Yeah, of
course. I think the Brussels sprout came on the scene in the 1580s, which is a real staple on the plate on Christmas Day in the UK these days.
Right, okay.
Vegetables, you know, were for the poor, really, because they couldn't afford the meat. So if you were a wealthy person, your feasting was meat-based, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. As you were speaking, I was just imagining how busy the kitchens at Hampton Court must have been at this time.
Yes.
Being the staff just non-stop, 24 hours being creating and amazing. It would have been so, so amazing to see. Fabulous.
Very hot as well.
Yes, exactly.
The fires must have been going all the time.
Absolutely. Okay. Very hot. Yeah, definitely. Many of us today exchange gifts on Christmas Day. However, the Tudors had a bit of a different tradition. They liked to exchange their gifts on New Year's Day. So this was really serious business at court and had great political significance. And the way in which the monarch received or responded to your gift was a sign of whether, you know, you were in favour or not. I was wondering, Claire, if you could talk to us a little bit about the protocol that governed this sort of important exchange of gifts, and maybe if you could share with us a couple of examples of gifts given at court.
Yes, yeah, it was very different. They didn't have, you know, Father Christmas. No, so there was none of this gift giving that was related to Christmas. Actually, the calendar New Year is very odd to us looking at primary source documents and that, because the calendar New Year started on Lady Day, which was the 25th of March.
Yeah, that's right.
They still celebrated the tradition of New Year on the 1st of January, which seems bizarre to us, but it was to do with the Roman tradition of New Year the Roman tradition of giving gifts at this time. So they nicked all that from the Romans. And so this was practiced at the Tudor court, and it was the traditional time for the monarch and favoured courtiers to exchange gifts. And these gifts were recorded in the gift roll. So you know, what you probably spent all year figuring out what you were going to give to the monarch, because your gift was going to be recorded for, you know, the rest of history, you know, on this gift roll. Now, these gifts, they could be, you know, plates, you know, silver gilt plate or whatever, jewels, pieces of jewelry, fabric, items of clothing, food. All sorts of things. And the king's and queen's gifts were, after the king and queen had you know, received them, were then displayed on buffets, which a buffet was a piece of furniture like a sideboard or a Welsh dresser. So your gift was also displayed for people to see. And you'd want to impress the monarch and his consort, because it was the queen as well, the queen consort who'd received gifts. And you'd want to impress other members of the court with your gift as well. So you'd want to do as much as you could afford. They were lavish gifts. And obviously, gifts then from the monarch to the courtier pointed to exactly who was in favour at that time. And the general way it worked was for a courtier to give the monarch a gift and then to be given a silver gilt plate in return. I don't think the monarchs ever really thought that carefully about what they were giving. They decided on who they were giving the present to, but I think they probably left it to servants to decide exactly what was being given.
Right.
And the gifts would be sent via a servant who would then be rewarded, you know, given a tip, you know, in cash for doing that. Historian Maria Hayward put a lot of research into the gift rolls from Henry VIII's reign and found that the average number of gifts that the king received each year was 181.
Whoa, that's a good amount.
Very well. And she also found that the most popular gift that was given to him was cold hard cash.
Wow.
That was the most popular thing.
Right.
Followed by, I think, second in popularity was plate. Things like drinking vessels, salts and spoons, all made from plate. And she explains the gift giving. I'll quote her because she's much better at putting it into words than I am. She says, gift giving at the New Year at the Henrician court was a very public event, and the patterns of loyalty, obligation and reciprocity were played out before everyone present and recorded for posterity in the gift rolls. As the exchange of gifts was undertaken for all to see, the potential for a gift to be construed as something closer to a bribe was eminently possible, but less likely than if the gift was received in private. So that there is that kind of thing that, you know, you might give the king something rather special this year because you need something off him.
That's right.
But Yeah, there, so there is that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a real tradition, and it was done in a very careful way. Mm. I mean, do you want me to give you some examples of gifts that were exchanged?
I'd love you to.
Okay, so here's some examples between monarch and courtier, or mm-hmm. monarch and family.
Okay.
1532, we've got Henry VIII giving the French queen, who of course was his sister Mary, mm-hmm. a pair of gilt pots and a gilt cup with a cover.
Right.
In return, she gave him, well, I like the sound of this, a pair of writing tables with a gold whistle.
Love it.
Yes, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
In the same year, so this is 1532, mm-hmm. this is quite a key year for this, he refused a gift from Catherine of Aragon.
Ooh, that's she not sent good. Him,
no, she sent him a gold cup. And not only did he refuse it, he didn't send her anything.
Oh, gosh.
But he did exchange gifts with Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
He sent her rich hangings and a bed covered with gold and silver cloth, crimson satin and embroidery.
Wow.
So very, very lavish gift.
Very lavish.
Well, she sent him some boar spears for his hunting.
Right.
So rather nice gifts there. Another example, fast forwarding to Elizabeth I. Mm-hmm. Or she had her favourite, Robert Dudley, Earl of Leicester.
Yes.
There's lots and lots of examples of gifts that they exchanged. But at New Year 1578-1579, he gave her a clock fully furnished with small diamonds and a pendant of gold, diamonds and rubies, and upon each side a lozenge diamond and an apple of gold enamelled green and russet.
My goodness. I mean, that's
useful, a diamond studded clock and then a pendant with all these jewels and an apple that's a jeweled apple. I mean, it just sounds splendid. And here's a kind of case of bribery.
Right.
In 1581, Philip Sidney, who we of course know for his poetry, mm-hmm. he'd fallen a bit out of favour at this point. So he decided that he had to sort of win Elizabeth around.
Right.
So this shows his sense of humour as well, because he gave her a gold jewel in the shape of a whip.
Right.
And it was set with diamonds and seed pearls. So he was, very symbolic.
Yeah, definitely. Goodness.
So he knew he was deserving of her sort of, punishment. But, I like that. That's a clever example, yes.
So clever. Oh, lovely. And just incredible lavish gifts. I just imagine seeing those things. Oh, goodness. Amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
And
stuff.
I do wonder how much attention the monarch actually paid any of these gifts.
I know, you kind of
think 181, you're not even going to really have time to look at those, are you?
I know, like briefly, like at the most, yeah. A second going, oh yeah, another jewel, another plate, another shirt. Another...
So in a way, as a courtier, you'd want your gift to be a bit different and stand
exactly.
out.
Exactly. That's so true. Mm. I know, that's very true. Wow, that was fabulous. Thank you so much for sharing those gifts. I love it. Another thing I love to do, Claire, I also love carols. I'm a big fan mm-hmm. of Christmas carols. And I know that they were also important, for the Tudor Christmas as well. I was wondering whether you have a favourite 16th century carol.
Well, all of my favourites tend to be a lot later. Mm-hmm. But the carol that I sort of like that was known at that period is the Coventry Carol.
I love that one too.
It's beautiful, but it's not at all festive and happy. Yeah. This was a carol that was a song that was performed as part of the Coventry mystery plays in the 16th century.
Yeah.
It's not entirely known it dated back to, but it was definitely around in the 16th century. And it's unfortunately about the massacre of the baby boys in Bethlehem by Herod. You know, those holy innocents, the children that are seen as the first saints.
Yeah.
And it's haunting rather than happy.
It is.
But
haunting,
I mean, I love, there's a YouTube video of King's College Cambridge choir singing it, and it is just amazing. It is such a beautiful, haunting song. But yes, you're just best to ignore the words.
That's
really
right. That's exactly right.
It's, just enjoy it for the music.
That's so true. I love it too, and I find it really atmospheric. Like, I like, you know, lighting the candles and playing that. And you do, you sort of can imagine yourself back in time. But and so what's our favorite modern one, if you prefer more modern? What do you like? What's one of the modern carols that you enjoy?
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure when this one dates back to, but I really like the Holly and the Ivy.
That's
one of my favorites. And good old Silent Night as well.
That's beautiful.
But the Holly and the Ivy, I'd have to say, is my very favorite.
Fantastic. Now it's that time of the episode where we're up to our little 10 to go game. Are you ready, Claire?
Oh yeah, well I hope you're going to be kind.
it's never hard. So because it is, you know, the Christmas period, I'd love to know what sort of two of your favorite Christmas traditions are.
I'd have to say board games.
Yes,
my very favorite. Yes, you know my love. I'm a complete board game geek, and in fact, our family is every weekend. I said to my son Joel this morning as he went off to school, you know, it's the weekend nearly. We can play a board game when you get back. We just absolutely love board games, and at Christmas, you know, it's the time my daughter will be home from university, so we can all, you know, get around the table and play a board game, and it just brings the family together for some fun. Apart from one of the traditions in, you know, my family was playing things like Monopoly, where it's not at all fun, really. Quite often ended in tears.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, exactly. I know people fighting.
Some of them go a little bit. So yeah, board games, and I'm trying to think. Here in Spain, Christmas is very different, and it's more, I mean, we have got the tradition of Father Christmas has crept in, Papa Noel has crept in now, but the main focus here is Epiphany, which they call King's Day, you know, the three kings. We have the three kings come to the village on the night of the 5th of January.
Right.
They come on the back of a truck but in some towns and cities they come on camels, and they have a procession with camels.
Okay.
And they go around our village throwing sweets to the crowd of villagers that follow behind this truck. And we collect the sweets, and then we all go to our village theatre, where the three kings sit on the stage and call the children up and give out presents.
Aww.
And I really, really love that tradition because the whole village gets involved.
Wow,
you know, we're
so
all
nice.
There with our bags to collect sweets. And it's just, it's lovely. So those are my two favourites of Christmas traditions.
And do they do, I know my family's from Uruguay, and there they also, you know, the that night is very important. And they used to put shoes out. Does anyone in Spain put like shoes out?
Yeah, you put your slippers out for the kings to put presents in. You have to make sure you've got big feet, really.
Yeah, put your biggest shoe that you've got.
Yes, and you put, you know, food out for the camel as well.
Oh, fabulous.
So a bit like we do, I mean, on Christmas Eve, even though my children are really old now, we still put out, you know, mince pie and, you know, a little bit of whiskey or brandy for Father Christmas, and a carrot for Rudolph as well. So yeah, that's very similar.
Yeah, it is. And I love those traditions.
I think you get, if you've been naughty, the kings leave you coal, don't they?
Yeah,
do they that in Uruguay?
I think that's the sort of threat that the children get, you know, coming up to
Christmas.
Yeah, and
you can actually buy in the shops candied coal.
Oh,
So that, you know, if the children do get coal left, it tends to be edible coal.
All right. Well, that's not too bad then, is it?
No.
All right. Great. And what are two items that are on your bucket list?
Ooh, my bucket list. Actually, to go to Australia.
Oh, lovely. That would be really nice so we could catch up again.
Yes. I've never been, and I would I'd love to travel more anyway.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, Australia, I'd absolutely love to visit Australia.
Definitely.
Another bucket list item. Oh, yeah, to win the lottery. It would have to be a big lottery and to just buy Hever Castle.
That's just a little wish. Come on, that's fine. That's
It would be so good to have as my address Clara Ridgeway, the Anne Boleyn Files, Hever Castle.
That sounds good. It's got a good ring to it, doesn't it?
It has.
Make and sure then, you invite me for the housewarming party, please.
Oh, yeah. And I'd open it up and we'd have lots of parties there, lots of Tudor-style parties.
So much fun. So
that's not really a serious bucket list item, but you just never know. I can put it on my vision board and it might happen.
That's exactly right. That's what they say to do. All right. And what do you do to recharge? I know you're super busy. You do so many things, juggling all different balls. So what's something you do to sort of, recharge the batteries?
Oh, well, the thing I really like to do, two very different things to unwind and recharge the batteries. I love exercising, obviously exhausts you as well, but it's that disconnection. You know, it's not work. I can forget, work for a bit while I just exercise. I love doing sort of combat and punching the air and everything and kicking So I do exercise. Mm-hmm. And then the complete opposite in an evening, grabbing a blanket, cuddling up on the sofa with something like a hot chocolate or a glass of wine a really good book or a good film and just just relaxing.
That sounds lovely. Really, really good. Apart from obviously history and Anne and that sort of thing, Anne Boleyn, what is something else that brings you joy?
I would have to say writing.
Yeah.
I mean, my first love was creative writing, going back to that story that I wrote when I was 11, which was very, very like Enid Blyton, a little bit darker, actually. I think I killed everyone.
Oh, right. It was that age where you're killing everyone, yeah. All right.
There's a little Venus Five, but coming to a nasty end.
Yeah, oh dear.
I'd have to say writing. I don't get chance these days to do writing creatively.
Yeah.
Really. I did do a course a few years back which I really enjoyed, which was creative writing for young adults.
And
I really loved that because my writing got critiqued by a tutor, and I really, really loved doing that because that got me back to that. I just don't get a chance these days, but I'd say writing and research I know it's my day job as well, but just getting lost in those 16th century documents is just, it's magic.
It is magic. I agree with you. What's a book that you're, what are you currently reading? You're probably reading lots of things, but what's one book that you're currently reading?
What am I reading? I've got on my list, I've got Janet Wertman's book next to me here. I've got Lauren Mackay's Among the Walls of Court book on Thomas and George Boleyn sat next to me here with Janet Wertman's book. So those two are on my to read.
Okay.
But actually I decided to disconnect from Tudor history and reread the Outlander series.
Oh yes, they're fabulous, aren't they?
I just love them. It's history, but it's fiction.
But it's fiction.
So I got my history thing. It's got some time travel in it.
Yes, I love that. Yeah. That's really cool. I like anything with the time travel element.
So that's to kind of disconnect from, my sort of work. But yes, I'm also going to start Janet and Lauren's books as well. I tend to have a few books on the go.
Mm.
One that isn't related to my work and then some that are sort of related to Tudor history as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's good to mix it up.
So, yeah.
All right, fabulous.
It
now, I know you said you wanted to do a little bit more travel, but what is a current sort of favourite holiday destination?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I really enjoyed last summer, we drove up to the UK to see family and we drove through France.
Oh, yeah.
And I used to go to France every summer because my dad was a French teacher, and he liked to go and practice his French to keep it sort of fluent. And so we got dragged to France every summer. And I didn't appreciate it then, but I really, really love it now. And oh, the chateaus, I mean, we've been to Amboise and Blois. Beautiful. And I love those. And also the connection with Anne Boleyn, to feel that you really are following in her footsteps. France actually is beautiful. So I love France, but also just getting to know Spain more. I mean, we've been here 12 years and we've hardly touched it. I really want to travel around Spain a bit more because it is so beautiful.
It's a
country of very different landscapes. I mean, we live in Andalusia. We're near to Granada, as you know. So we've got the Sierras, we've got the mountain scenery, but we're also very arid and we've got sort of desert sort of landscape as well. So even on my doorstep, there's very different, things to explore. So France and getting to know Spain a bit more.
All right, fabulous. Now, on the topic of Spain, what's, apart from the landscape you've told us, what's something that you really love about living in Spain?
The one thing that really I like is the connection to Tudor history that I get here. Now, that sounds bizarre because obviously the Tudors weren't in Spain, but it's because the life here is still, it's a Catholic sort of country.
Yes.
Still the religious calendar is still important here. We have, feast days to do with the saints.
Yeah.
Christmas is more about Epiphany, and I get more of an insight into sort of how the Tudors lived according to the religious calendar. We've got Immaculate Conception Day coming up, which is a public holiday. So there's that, and there's also the how people are in touch with the food they eat as well. We've just been invited. I'm not sure I'll be going, but we've been invited to a matanza, which is the annual slaughter of the pig. Families bring up pigs to slaughter, and then they pretty much eat every part of that pig. The pig's looked after very well
with
the family environment. And then they slaughter it, and it is, they eat every bit of it. And that, of course, is like in Tudor times, where they have, I think it was related to Martinmas in Tudor times, where you have that annual slaughter of the pig, and you prepare it, and it keeps you going the rest of the winter. And so there's the connections like that, and the fact that we eat seasonal fruit and vegetables here. We can't get certain fruit and veg all year round. It's very seasonal, and it gives me that connection back to how the Tudors lived.
Yeah, I see exactly what you mean. Yeah, and it seems like obviously in Spain, ancient traditions are still important, and people still practice them, which is fabulous. I love it.
It just helps me make that connection. But also, I'd have to say the other thing is the more outdoor lifestyle as well. the UK. I love the UK. It will always be,
of course,
one of my homes.
Yeah,
but it's just you plan a barbecue and then you have to barbecue under an umbrella in the garden while everyone else is indoors. Whereas here you can barbecue most days. It's cold at the moment, but it's sunny and dry.
It's different.
We could still go barbecue in the garden if we wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Now, what was your first paid job?
I used to be, my first proper job was a waitress in a burger bar.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
So lovely, doesn't it? Yeah, I throughout university, I used to spend my holidays, every uni holiday, waitressing in a burger bar. To earn some money.
That's fine.
Yeah,
great.
And I actually loved it. It got a bit greasy and a bit smelly, but I loved it.
I got
to know the regular customers, and it was nice.
Oh, fabulous. What three new skills would you like to learn? If you could learn some new skills, what would they be?
Three new skills.
If you don't have three, it could be one or two.
Well, I've just learned how to loom knit, knitting on a circular loom. So I got into that last winter, really. Everyone was receiving knitted things for Christmas that year. But I'd like to actually be able to knit with, you know, needles.
Yes.
So that's one. I'd like to learn how to crochet because I'm in awe of people that crochet things because it always looks so beautiful. Oh, the third one. What would I like to learn how to do? Oh, I can't think of anything.
That's all right. We can leave it at two. That sounds good. So creative things. I like that. Doing things with your hands. That's very good.
Oh, yeah, to paint.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps I used to do watercolor painting, but I wasn't that great at it. I'd love to be able to just you see these people, you know, on TV just do a few strokes and all of a sudden it's a landscape.
It's incredible, it's just... isn't it? Yeah. I kind of envy that a little bit. All right, lucky last, really extremely important question, Claire. If someone's taking you out for a drink, what are you ordering?
A sparkling water.
That's pathetic. That's easy. Okay.
No, that's at the moment. I won't go into too much information, but I'm on a restrictive diet due to sort of health reasons, not dieting. Yep. And I'm not allowed alcohol or things with additives. So sparkling water is the thing.
Are you allowed a lemon slice in the sparkling?
Yes, I could have ice and lemon in it. But usually it would be a glass of red wine.
Nice. And Spain has a lot of
white wine. I quite like white wine in the summer. In Spain also we have a popular summer drink that I love is Tinto de Verano, which is red wine mixed with casera, which isn't as sweet as lemonade, but it isn't soda water either. It's a fizzy sort of drink. And then sometimes they put a little bit of martini in it as well. And it's just a lovely, lovely, refreshing, long summer drink, a bit like sangria.
All right, fabulous.
But yeah, at the moment, sparkling water.
All right, sparkling water, that's okay. Nothing wrong with that. Very healthy. And now we're up to our very last thing, which is our Tudor takeaway, a little gem for us to investigate or have a look at after the episode. So what's your Tudor takeaway, Claire?
I would, if this was sort of as like advice for people, something to kind of encourage people in Tudor history, then I'd say that if you really, really want to immerse yourself in Tudor history, wherever you are in the world, it is possible to do. Like as you and I know very well, you don't have to have the National Archives on your doorstep or the British Library on your doorstep. You can get stuck into the primary sources, and anyone that really wants to immerse themselves in Tudor history needs to look at the primary sources. Biographies, books and that are wonderful, but there's nothing like reading the real words of Tudor people for yourself. And there's been so much transcribed and digitized today on websites like British History Online, archive.org. And so it really is possible to read real Tudor documents, letters, chronicles, you know, like Edward Hall's Chronicle, for example, is a real favourite of mine. Yeah. And you can do that, you know, whether you're in Australia, Spain, America, Canada, you can do that online on a website. And I just that reading their own words, their own thoughts, their own accounts, their own feelings, it just gives you such an insight into the people and their times. And I get lost for hours in them. When I first received the volumes of the Lyell letters.
Fascinating.
Wow. I just got stuck into them and the whole day would go by and I'd still be stuck in them because they're amazing. And sometimes the humour that comes into them it's real insight. And I just love that. And you can do that wherever you are in the world. And it's far better than, you know, just relying on the on books.
Exactly. That's so true. What fantastic advice. Thank you so much, Claire, for joining me today on Talking Tutors. I've had such a good time.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really lovely. And I look forward to hopefully talking again with you soon.
Yes, that would be lovely.
All right. Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetutortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.